The souls of the righteous are in the hands of God, and no torment will ever touch them. For the benefit of the lifelong Presbyterians in this crowd this morning, raised as I was to believe that Presbyterians did not observe All Saints' Day, I begin by offering a bit of history. All Saints' Day can be traced to the very beginning of the Church's life. During the first 3 centuries after Christ's death and resurrection, when the Roman Empire was awash in the blood of Christian martyrs, the Church began to remember those who had died in the faith by designating the day of their death as a holy day. Given Rome's unrelenting persecution of Christians, eventually almost every day became a saint's day. A good idea gone viral, I guess you could say today. So in 607 AD, Boniface III designated the Sunday after Pentecost in the Eastern Church as the Sunday when the deaths of all the saints were to be remembered in worship. A century later, the Western Church chose November 1st for the same purpose. A few hundred years after that, in the 10th century, November 2nd became All Souls Day, when the Church honored and prayed for all Christians who had died. Here, I think, is where the plot thickens theologically. By the 12th century, praying for the dead began to involve paying for the dead in order that they might be purged of their earthly sin and purified in preparation for their heavenly home. Purgatory was given definition by Pope Innocent IV in the 13th century, and soon after that, the Second Council of Lyon institutionalized the dogma as well as the practice of indulgences. And in 1300, Pope Boniface, some other number, declared a jubilee of plenary indulgences. Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, and the stage was set for the Reformation. Luther called the Church out for her corrupt use of indulgences. Calvin railed against the intercession of the saints and praying for the dead, believing such practices presumed Christ's intercession to be insufficient. And that is why I grew up as a Presbyterian not celebrating All Saints' Day. Now, of course, our latest Book of Common Worship in the Presbyterian Church offers an entire liturgy for the day, including the promise of the gospel spoken by Austin at the baptismal font. But our embrace of the yearly observation has left something important about our relationship to the dead unexamined. That something has to do with the error our own tradition not only missed, but intensified when we quit both the veneration of saints and the intercession of the saints, and at the practice of praying for the dead in favor of the doctrine of predestination. That doctrine means to assure us that our final destination is in God's hand, and not the result of our own good works. Instead, over the centuries, it has invited us to obsess about who is saved, who is damned, and how we can live so as too cynical. But both doctrines keep the church in business, allowing the Roman Church to keep in place its role as the broker of salvation, and encouraging Protestants to fearfully and eternally be obsessed with themselves. Neither turns us toward the hope for which we were made. That hope has everything to do with the communion of saints and the cloud of witnesses who surround us even now. Properly understood, the saints do not intercede on our behalf with God, I think. Rather, their witness eggs us on to do something brave, to live as though death had no dominion. So it was that the elder John, in exile on a little island named Patmos, wrote to the seven churches in Asia Minor, whose members were being fed to the lions. He tells the about to be martyred that the agony and torture inflicted upon God's children by Caesar finally will be no more. Neither tears, nor mourning, nor sorrow, nor pain. To keep them keeping on, he fuels their imagination for the holy city, the heavenly banquet, the gathering of all nations in the love God is. But notice this. Everything is plural. Plural. As the New Testament scholar N.T. Wright puts it, this do we? Do we? According to Jens, the church so cripples its saying of the gospel. By the way, it does, the Eucharist. We take every chance to represent not Jesus and his fellowship, Jens says, but our own religious concerns. Instead of making a cheerful family party, we organize processions of religiosity, each coming singularly for a private dose of holiness. Holier or more hygienic than God, instead of sharing a cup, we take each a little shot glass. Instead of bread, he says, of his own tradition, we eat a sort of paper, symbolic bread, as it were. Likewise, in his book entitled What Happens at Holy Communion, Reformed theologian and friend Michael Velker describes his experience of the supper at my former congregation in Princeton as a sad colloquy and a private mass. He says, like airplane passengers being served by a flight attendant, they were offered crumbs of bread and tiny plastic cups of juice. The very thing that was supposed to be a high point in the life of the church appeared to me here as a sad low point in the life of an otherwise flourishing and most lively congregation. I have to tell you that I bristled when I first read those words. And yet I took the report of his experience to heart. But I failed to take to heart, save with the session, was Michael's counsel that a community must think long and hard and together as it considers how the celebration of the supper says the gospel to those from north and south and east and west who have been invited to the table. Two questions I leave with you. How might our service of the supper fuel this congregation's imagination for the holy city, the heavenly banquet, the gathering of all nations, the joyful feast of the people of God? And then second, in what ways does our service presume we have come for our own private doses of holiness, whether we sit to be served or stand self-consciously in line? If I could change the architecture of this sanctuary for the sake of saying the gospel, put on your seatbelts, I would remove all of the pews in favor of chapel chairs. You're lucky I'm not here long enough to try that. I would put a big family table in the middle of the nave and invite us on Communion Sundays to form a circle around the table, some standing, some sitting, but all in the circle. There would be one big loaf on the table, broken into four pieces, and carried by the elders to the four corners of the circle. The bread of heaven, the elder would say to the first, and the first would say to the next, until all had bread. Then from a common pitcher, four cups would be filled. to speak to